Welcome to the Australian Catholic Historical Society's first talk by Zoom. This is a historic moment for the Society because we're finally able to overcome the tyranny of distance and get outside our Sydney and Melbourne bubble and become a truly national society, as we've wished to do for the last 80 years, but we haven't been able to. Well, now it's possible. So welcome especially to those who are watching from distant places. I'm James Franklin, the Vice President of the Society and the editor of our journal. I'll host the meeting and direct question time at the end. The talk should go for about 30 minutes, give or take, and after that we'll have a question time. Now let me introduce our speaker. Dr. John Carmody is President of the Society and has been doing a dynamic job at that for the last 10 years. He's also a former academic at the University of New South Wales in physiology and pharmacology, and he's well known as a writer on music and opera, and also as a teller of yarns in the fashion typical of the Irish. Over to Dr. Carmody now on his topic on the Protestant aspects of Sydney University. Jack, over to you.
Thanks, Jim. First of all, welcome everybody. Could I endorse Professor Franklin's welcome to this September meeting of the Society? And as he said, it's a new venture for ACHS. And of course, there's some nervousness about our own experience, especially from me. The truth is that our council is very keen that we should continue to provide events for our members, and therefore that we should try our hand at Zoom, hoping that we could make a go of it. I trust that we've avoided too many big technical pitfalls. I should add that I'm very grateful to Helen Scanlon for organising the session and for ensuring that we did some rehearsing. Although Jim did say if we're going to mess it up, we better mess it up on the grand scale after a bit of rehearsal. Furthermore, I should add that my wife insisted that as president, I should depart from my usual practice of keeping myself off the schedule and must, as they say, lead from the front, unlike the Duke of Plaza Toro. I'm mightily impressed by the number of bookings which we've attracted, and I hope that wherever you are, you will not be disappointed. Thank you for your support. So off we go. Wentworth's dream of a secular university thwarted. How Sydney University became a decidedly Protestant institution. In 1959, the eminent Australian historian, J.J. Auchmuty, made this misguided assertion about Australia's universities. They are, he said, without exception, firmly organised on a purely secular and a non-sectarian basis. It was not true even then in 1959 when he said it, and he has certainly overlooked the efforts by Archbishop Gilroy in the early 1940s to establish a University of Notre Dame in Sydney. Furthermore, the success of the Federated Australian Catholic University, ACU, and as well of the University of Notre Dame Australia now makes that gestalt claim very dated indeed. That first university in Australia was established in Sydney in 1850, barely 70 years after the convict colony was established. As might be expected from the nest from which this sometimes cantankerous nation emerged, its origins were fraught. The driving force was two people: the extraordinary Irish internationalist physician Henry Grattan Douglas. Anyway, Henry Grattan Douglas, an internationalist Irish physician, and the dynamic barrister William Charles Wentworth. Wentworth was the son of a convict mother and the dashing Irish aristocrat and colonial surgeon Darcy Wentworth, who in Britain, incidentally, it's a recent book has said that Wentworth is the Mr. Darcy of the Jane Austen novels. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, in Britain, he had been an accused highwayman. The younger Wentworth was therefore very well aware of the snobbery of Oxford and Cambridge, with their confessional admission tests, which embodied established Church of England power and orthodoxy. He would also have been very intimately familiar as a lawyer with the so-called Church Act of 1836, which had been sponsored in New South Wales by two Irishmen, the Governor Richard Burke and his Attorney General John Plunkett. Amongst other things, especially the payment of the clergy, that was quite radical, It essentially ensured that the Church of England was not an established church in this Antipodean colony. It's an established church in England, but we've avoided having any established church in Australia. Obviously, however, if only by force of its numbers, not to mention the senior social positions of some of its adherents, that denomination, the Church of England, remained powerful and influential. Accordingly, Wentworth made his views abundantly clear when in October 1849 he addressed the New South Wales Legislative Council after the bill to establish colonial university had been introduced. His speech included this ringing declaration: "In after years, it is my earnest hope that we may survey this institution affording, in its extended sphere, education and instruction, not to the natives of this colony alone, but to the whole family of the human race, that it may prove a fountain of knowledge at whose springs may all may drink, be they Christian, Mohammedan, Jew, or heathen, that its gates will be open to all, whether they are disciples of Moses or Jesus, of Brahman, of Mohammed, of Vishnu, of Buddha." His determination was made clear in Clause 5 of his bill. Having proposed the constitution of the Senate, a number of its members, it went on to add this, and I might say that even though I'm not a lawyer, I've read quite a few Acts of Parliament in my time, and never once have I seen one so carefully written to exclude any loopholes. It said, "Provided always that no clerk in holy orders, nor any minister, preacher, ecclesiastic, catechist, or teacher of any religious creed or denomination whatsoever shall be eligible for election as a member of the said Senate, and that every election of any such person shall be ipso facto invalid." That bill has been provided to the Legislative Council in record time, just 2 weeks, and the churches had been caught napping. They then acted promptly and had an amendment moved in the committee stage. Thereupon, Wentworth's bill, or a crucial clause of it, faced likely defeat, the one that would exclude the clerics from any power in the university. Before that could happen, sufficient members of the council left the chamber, and the council was, in the language of the time, counted out. That is, it lapsed for want of a quorum. Few members really wanted to defeat Wentworth. A year later, when he reintroduced his bill on the 23rd of August, 1850, Wentworth was obliged to accept a compromise, namely that a minimum of 4 of the 16 members of that formation Senate could be clergymen, one for each of the major denominations, Catholic, Methodist, Presbyterian, and Anglican. Thereafter, with real reverberations for education in New South Wales, Wentworth's hope for a totally secular university was seriously compromised. This was despite the fact that initially the Anglican bishop refused to take one of those earmarked places, which was bizarre, even petulant behaviour, given that his flock was, after all, the largest by far in the colony, perhaps 45 to 50% of the population. But that animus evaporated within a few years when he realised what a lost opportunity it was. Nevertheless, the privileged and prosperous place of that church in the colony, not to mention how the lower, essentially working class and Irish status of most of the 25% who are Catholics, cemented that Anglican ascendancy. The fragmented nature of the remaining Christian denominations, no more than 20% of the population in any case, only reinforced the power of the adherents of the Church of England. This fundamentally sectarian characteristic was perhaps relevant to Sydney University's early hostility to the fledgling University of Technology. Its utter failure to read the mind of the New South Wales government in 1948, and its continuing, in Patrick O'Farrell's memorable phrase, to ride high horse in vain. In a word, it would grudgingly accept a new institute, but emphatically not a university. Perhaps in the light of what I've said, this was because, in O'Farrell's words, It was because some New South Wales people believed that, quote, the bureaucracy of the new university derived from the public service and was repeatedly the home of Roman Catholics, unquote. Later, referring to the new medical faculty specifically, O'Farrell wrote that it, quote, had a staff significantly Catholic, or so it was believed, though precise actuality suggested perhaps otherwise, unquote. This brings to mind, to my mind anyway, Hamlet's remark to Rosencrantz, there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. In short, what was important is not reality, but what people perceive and therefore believe. The point is that at least during its first 50 to 100 years, at any rate, Sydney University was not at all the secular institution which Julia Horne and Geoffrey Sherrington claimed in their book about the university recently, or Kenneth Cable before them. For example, it took over 40 years until 1891 for the first Catholic to be appointed to a chair, Thomas Butler in Latin. And perhaps that doesn't count because who else spoke Latin but the Catholics? It was 1943 before there was a Catholic or even a female deputy chancellor, and that was Dame Constance Darcy, the obstetrician. And it took until 1964 for there to be a Catholic chancellor, Sir Charles MacDonald, the physician. Nor, have I already said, is the claim by these recent university historians plausibly substantiated by quoting Ocmuti's misguided assertion, argumentum ad verecundiam, that is, appealing to authorities, is at best a dubious procedure. Even so, the Catholics did not want to be left behind. In 1857, Archbishop Poulding used a pastoral letter to open the fundraising campaign for St. John's College, following the opening of St. Paul's Anglican College in the previous year. Plainly, though an urbane English Benedictine, he was concerned by the Protestant nature of the university even then, saying in 1859, quote, I cannot in conscience send our Catholic young men to the lectures of non-Catholic professors unattended by a Catholic tutor. Not sure whether he wanted the tutors to sit in on them or not, but anyway, that was what he said. And it was, in fact, not until 1928 that a Catholic student society, the Newman Society, was begun. And in its early years, at least, its membership was fewer than 100 students. O'Farrell suggests that the trigger for its foundation was, quote, the scathing anti-religious polemic, unquote, of the professor of philosophy, John Anderson. Indeed, a comment in his History of the University of New South Wales by Pat O'Farrell implies that that relations with staff were not close in the Sydney society, perhaps because those staff were predominantly Protestants at Sydney University. And he draws the contrast between Sydney University and the University of New South Wales in that respect, in that the staff and students were much closer at the younger university. It's worth saying here, though, to demonstrate that sectarianism could, as they say, cut both ways, that when my wife was an undergraduate resident of St. Sophia College, the nuns would allow her to study philosophy, one, under Professor Anderson, only on the condition that at the same time she studied philosophy under Dr. Woodbury at the Aquinas Academy in the city. One instance of the fundamental Protestant strand of the university which challenges the almost sainted status of the foundation professor of physiology and anatomy and later dean, Thomas Peter Anderson Stewart, is this academic icon's deep involvement with both Freemasonry, where he was Deputy Grand Master of New South Wales, and eugenics. Eugenics is, I believe, a prejudiced and racist dogma which Australian Catholicism vigorously rejected.
Paper down.
It is also of interest that 4 years after his death, a Masonic lodge was established at Sydney University in 1924, and it operates to this day. I'm not sure how many people realise there is an active Masonic lodge at the University of Sydney. And that lodge has used the Great Hall for its grander ceremonies, and at one stage, so I was advised, even had a room in the quadrangle building got up as a Masonic temple. Anderson Stewart was, as I said, a committed eugenicist. He was an official delegate of the Australian government at the first International Congress of Eugenics in London in 1912. He was a racist to boot, being a supporter of the White Australia policy and one-time president of Dr. Richard Arthur's Immigration League of Australia, which was a very racist movement. Of course, it's impossible now to know how many academics across the wider university. There were numerous in the medical faculty, but it's difficult to know how many academics supported those causes. The likelihood, though, is that it was a significant number, because most of them would probably have been Protestants. And as the Australian historian Diana Wyndham has noted, the Catholic clergy were implacably opposed to eugenics. A further probable sectarian matter from the 1920s was the dismissal of the poet and linguist Christopher Brennan in mid-1925. And this was not on the grounds of his public inebriation, which might well have offered grounds for such a puritanical body as the University Senate, but for adultery, which became publicly known only when, some months after the presumed suicide of his mistress, his estranged wife initiated divorce proceedings, which had been reported in the Sydney Morning Herald. And that was a scandal, which the university authorities were plainly desperate to avoid, and it provoked them into urgent action. The Senate convened to deal with him a bare week later. The subsequent details are recorded in the Senate minutes, and Axel Clark summarised them admirably in his biography of Brennan. Crocodile tears seem to have been shed by several fellows of the Senate, but the really damning speech was made by Arthur Mills, the Dean of Medicine, that most respectable of faculties, who seems to have been bitterly censorious. Axel Clark wrote, "Mills said that he spoke with reluctance and great pain. From the university's point of view, even granting Brennan was an irreplaceable genius." This is an extraordinary sentence, I think, and it says something about social respectability rather than academic standards. "But Mills said he spoke with reluctance and great pain. From the university's point of view, even granting Brennan was an irreplaceable genius, it was better to have men to whom they could look for high character and principles. What would happen," Mills asked, "now that Brennan's case was public property, known to the parents of students?" Mills' conscience told him that the Senate had no course open to it, except the one already decided in Irvine's previous case. That was Professor Robert Irvine, the economist, who was having affairs with staff and students, I think. The new Chief Justice, Sir Philip Street, supported Mills' view, and he thought that in the circumstances, Brennan must be prepared to pay the price for his actions, unquote. For the age-old sin of adultery, this seems to have been the sheerest hypocrisy from all of them, but especially from Justice Street, recently appointed Chief Justice, whose interest in other women than his wife was even then apparently notorious, a reputation which that his descendants seem to have reinforced. Apparently a great fault in the adultery itself was that it had emerged into public view. This is the attitude of the Puritan humbug. Mungo McCallum, the former warden who had very recently assumed the new office of Vice-Chancellor, argued that, quote, "the senators could not possibly overlook this matter, since it had become public. If they were to continue on the staff, a man publicly proclaimed to have been guilty of a breach of the sacredness of marriage, that must affect the minds of their young people," unquote. If such a punitive justice were insisted on nowadays, perhaps half the staff might have to resign. It was the sheerest humbug from those professional Puritans, and it is difficult for me now not to think that Brennan's Catholicism was a relevant but unstated fault too. After all, he had Irish parents. His father had been a brewer in Dublin, and the Irish, then considered working class and unwashed, even of a separate and more primitive race, for all that they had higher aspirations and little interest in, quote, keeping the lifeline to Ireland, they were in various ways discouraged from joining the academic community. As Clark wrote in reflecting on the Kangaroo Court, which dispatched Brennan, quote, they made the university not so much a temple of learning as what Brennan now recognised to be an intellectual temple of British Philistinism, an institution more likely to frown on than sympathise with the Irish rebel. How naive he must have been to think that such an institution would sympathise with these lines. But anyway, Brennan now recognised that it was an intellectual temple of British Philistinism, an institution more likely to frown on than sympathise with the Irish rebel, the independent-minded scholar, the man capable of passionate love, and the pilgrim searching for religious satisfaction. He's talking about academics. Other offensively sectarian acts, as late as the 1940s, were the shameful reaction, admittedly much of it was outside the university, to the professorial appointment of Julius Stone, or a few years later to the proposed employment of the internationally renowned scientific philosopher Karl Popper, who even in Parliament, as well as in representations to the Senate, was characterised as, quote, an unnaturalised enemy alien. He was a Jewish Austrian escaping from the Reich to faraway New Zealand, but he was still categorized as an unnaturalized enemy alien. And when the Senate came to vote for him, they voted by one vote to appoint him, and he wouldn't accept it. Both scandals were blatant anti-Semitism, dressed up, of course, as protection of the interests of local candidates who are currently in the armed services protecting their native land. It was, however, mere self-serving, in my view, it was nothing more than self-serving sectarianism and cant and unworthy propaganda. Michael Hogan did not consider those two scandals in his splendid book, The Sectarian Strand, though they were blazing examples of what he characterised as, quote, Australian versions of racism, which have poisoned the whole community with an ideology of Anglo-Saxon superiority and race purity, which has consigned Jews together with Aborigines, Asians, and non-Europeans to a position of inferiority. The ideology, Hogan wrote, has had a strong religious component, unquote. The tortuous history of Sydney University reveals those sectarian characteristics clearly. This was on full display rather than merely tested in those Stone and Popper affairs. They also showed that religious attitudes are especially fraught in wartime. For the university, that was on display right from the time of the Boer War, when imperial sympathies of the majority of its members were revealed, and neither staff nor students were actually covered with glory, as dissidents were dealt with pretty harshly. Dissidence has never been tolerated well at Sydney University. All of this demonstrated my own axiom that education lays a veneer over our emotions, but it is disturbingly thin. Those skirmishes are mostly Protestant contra Catholic, but they also have more than a whiff of Tory versus Labour and Enlightenment versus artisanal. Even in the case, as the case of medicine regrettably showed in the 1950s, humanistic contra technological. That science versus humanities schism was there from the very birth of Sydney University and plainly still had force in 1945 when planning was underway for University of New South Wales. In 1847, the Select Committee on the Sydney College, had later become Sydney University, of course, reported to the Legislative Council of New South Wales with an appropriate bill. They said, we've been able to report so quickly because, and we needed to call no witnesses to support our arguments because everybody on the committee thought we should have a university. I love that. If only everyone could agree these days. However, their report also included this clause, all too readily forgotten. The first professor should be in classics and mathematics at £800 a year. This appointment to be the principal of the university. Chemistry at £400 a year, natural history, including the animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdoms at £400 a year, experimental philosophy and civil engineering, as well as anatomy, physiology, and medicine, both at £300 a year. For some reason, which is left completely unstated in its minutes, the Foundation Senate, with its clerical membership, chose to ignore this advice and resolved to appoint only three Foundation chairs in classics, Woolley, mathematics, Pell, and chemistry and experimental physics, Smith. We can only speculate on their reasons. Were they concerned that a Foundation faculty of six would be too expensive, especially because the rejected three would have required, in addition to salaries, expensive laboratories and technical staff to run them? Or was it rather because they were frightened of recent developments in biological science? After all, the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species was not far off at that time, and those ideas were already in circulation. Were the religious leaders, therefore, especially concerned by the notion of evolution? In this respect, there is a possibly relevant comment in the entry on Johann Kreft, curator of the Australian Museum in Sydney, which was written in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. Kreft, it said, was one of the few Australian scientists to accept Darwin's theory of evolution and disseminate his ideas in the 1860s. Those decisions to reject the scientific and engineering disciplines are not decisions of the Senate of a truly secular university. At any event, the intellectual loss for the university and for Australian science and education was profound. T.H. Huxley was very interested in that chair of natural history, and his presence in the colony would have been enormously influential, not to mention the parallel question of how Darwinism might have been held back in Britain if he'd not there, been there to proselytize on behalf of Darwin and his bulldog. A truly secular university would certainly have appointed Huxley to its foundation chair, but it did not. So the first nail in that secular academic coffin was, as I have detailed, Wentworth's parliamentary compromise. The second was the abandonment of those scientific chairs with the attendant immeasurably important loss of Huxley. And the third, in my view, was the appointment of an Anglican clergyman, Dr. John Woolley, to be its foundation principal. Those three things meant that, the provisions of the Burke-Plunkett Church Act of 1836 notwithstanding, the nascent university inevitably became a secular institution. And because Anglicans were in control, it became a Protestant Anglican institution, because Anglicanism in Sydney is fundamentally Calvinist in its nature. So it's more plausibly the changing times with their essentially secular values and not the preferences of the power brokers of that first Australian university, which have diluted the sectarian nature of the university. And I believe it has been diluted in recent years. At this very time of COVID, we may be witnessing a change of eras within society at large, but specifically in that university, and with that, a change of values. The recent appointment of Mark Scott as Vice Chancellor has drawn some adverse comment from a number of academics. They insist he is a manager and not an academic or a scholar. Perhaps that is true, but modern universities have, for better or worse, become corporations and mercantile entities at that. Perhaps Sydney really does need a manager, and that of itself would represent a change of values. But there is more, I think. Mark Scott's predecessor as Vice Chancellor was an Anglican clergyman, Dr. Michael Spence. So if the university is moving into a new era, then we might note that the passing era, which began with a Church of England priest at the helm, ended in the same way. And it may be that, like the wider society which it and its graduates purport to serve, the university is in the process of transformation into a truly secular community. A fortiori, it may prove that with the influx of students from Asia, which will also reinforce those changes in the wider Australian society, we may come to realise that we have entered upon a new academic era in which the University of Sydney is back on the trajectory which W.C. Wentworth intended for it in 1849. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Jack. John, thanks very much. Plenty of material to keep us thinking about there. And now we'll have some question time. Any question? Brian Lucas would like to ask something.
Well, my question, which I put on the chat, John, to what extent, if at all, both in the past and perhaps now, did the religious colleges, such as St. John's, did they have any influence on the religious culture of the university, either through the students or the tutors or the leadership?
That's a question in its own right, worthy of a talk in its own right. Wentworth wanted the model to be not Oxford, Cambridge, where the colleges were integral, but London University. And, of course, one of the changes that happened pretty early in the piece was that there was a bit of a dispute between whether the university would therefore be a purely examining institution or whether it would be a teaching institution through the colleges. That's one point. Another point is that they've always been on the periphery, it seems to me, geographically and probably as well in other ways. So they've never been part of the teaching faculty of the university in the same way. To a varying degree, they've had tutors, visiting tutors and the like. But I don't think they've been... Certainly, I think the people like the founders of St. Paul's and Poulding wanted them to be influential, but I suspect that they haven't really been, but I'd leave that to other people to decide. It's a question that I realised I might have considered, but that would be a talk in its own right, I think.
Thanks. Next question from Julia Horn.
Thank you, John. Thank you. I'm one half of the co-authorship of the book mentioned, of course, the other half being Geoffrey Sherington. Geoffrey Sherington is Anglican, is Protestant, I'm not. But I think you're actually being a bit unfair about characterising what we actually say. So I did want to just quickly say why I think that. We're not, you know, the point about our claim that the University of Sydney was started on a secular basis was very much of the time. And that is, you know, at that time, in order to get into Oxford or Cambridge, where many of the colonists, the, you know, sons of wealthy colonists went, you had to proclaim the 39 Articles of the Anglican Faith. And the University of Sydney was, you know, Wentworth's idea, you know, he happened to be the person who professed it in Parliament, in the Legislative Council. But there were, of course, along with Douglas, Henry Grattan Douglas, there were others, of course, who had started talking about it. And they were, you know, the whole point was that they didn't want a university where you had to profess Anglican faith, that was the means of entering into the university. And they achieved that. And that particular aspect of entering the university, you could be from any religious faith or none. You could be Jewish. There were Jewish, early Jewish students there. That was, you know, nothing like that had happened before in the English-speaking world. And that's been retained, essentially, that, you know, it doesn't matter what religion you are, you can come to university. And the second point there is that, of course, I mean, you illuminate this, which I was pleased about, that when the clerics come onto the Senate, one of them is, you know, Catholic, and that's partly because in all the, you know, wrangling over this godless institution, as the Anglicans were calling it when it was founded, was the concern that their schools, which were deeply divided from the schools established by the New South Wales government, which were Protestant, you know, were Anglican, even though they were public, that the Catholic education system system, if it was called that then, Catholic schools actually embraced the University of Sydney from the very beginning. Our work showed that, you know, we looked at all the students and that there was a clear, you know, there was a significant minority of students who, a large minority of students who were Catholic, which was retained from thereafter. So while I certainly take your point that, you know, that if you looked at the staff, there may well have been, I mean, you know, those first three professors, Woolley is Anglican, Smith isn't, he's the son of a blacksmith, he's Scottish, he's Presbyterian. I wouldn't put that together with Anglicanism. And Pell was American. Yes, there may, if you look at all the professors, I'm not arguing that there wasn't Anglican preference in different disciplines. But I think that's one side of the question. But the other is actually how the schools relate to the university and were the Catholic schools continuing to want to send their you know, sons and later daughters to the University of Sydney. And, you know, the evidence there is that they did. So I would just say that it's a really complex question. And, I mean, we were just looking at secularism at that time in the 1850s. In fact, we have another chapter in our book about faith, which was, you know, raising some of the sorts of points that you mentioned. So I just, you know, I just felt that I had to, Jeff can't be here, of course, but I wanted to defend our position there because I think it's too simplified how you've sort of characterised our work, actually. So thank you.
I take that point, Julia, but you did call it a secular university. That was part of the title.
And no, it wasn't. I'm sorry, that's wrong. The title is The University of Sydney, The Making of a Public University. Our book was about a public university.
Okay.
It was
okay,
not about a secular university. The secular part was about the debates that were happening with Wentworth, which you, you know, which you nicely talk about there. And then the whole question that the churches, including the Catholic, the Presbyterians, the Anglicans, and the Methodists, or not the Methodists, whoever, are fighting at that time over the fact they do not like this godless institution and they want to come to a concordat, as it were, with the government over that. So we use the word secular to describe that particular period, but we understood that, you know, our book goes much more, that a public, so our book was about being a public university, not about being a secular university. Our argument was about what does this look like as a public university from 1850 up till when the book was published in 1912.
Okay.
Oh, that's correctly you.
But I don't think that it remained an irreligious university because or an anti-religious university at all, because the Sydney Anglicans were Calvinists. They were close to Presbyterians at that stage, and they're all pretty much of the same venue, the same values.
Next question from Anne Toming. After that, Ed Campion. Anne.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Thanks very much, John. It was, as always, really, really interesting. If I'd just like to pick up on a couple of points there, one that Julia made, and also the question that Brian raised about the colleges. In some of the work I've been doing, one of the things I did was actually track the religion of some of the doctors, for example, as they went through university. And you can see quite clearly there that as the Catholic schools came online from the 1870s onwards, you're getting a whole raft of students that are, you know, qualified for admission to Sydney University that are starting to get into the professions there. And I think I recall that when I looked at the percentage growth in the medical faculty, it was the Catholic doctors that really were growing very, very fast compared to some of the other groups. But, you know, mind you, some of them were large anyway. And the other major group was the Congregationalists. They were sort of quite significant at that time. And of course, as those students went through, they were really celebrated within the Catholic press, like in Freeman's Journal. their names were published, you know, they got into university. It was a really, really big deal. The schools were sort of applauded for their success. So it was kind of nice to see that as education ramped up for everyone within New South Wales, that you're seeing that, you know, the positive effect of that in the professions and the other occupations. Now, someone I've been looking a little bit closely at, and people would be familiar with Herbert Moore, and picking up on your point, Brian, he was a close mate of Maurice O'Reilly later on, but there was like about a 20-year gap when there was almost practically no connection between St John's College and the university because of a little stoush, little political thing that happened within the college itself when someone took offence at something and decided they didn't want to be there and took the library and went off and gave it to the, you know, the new seminary at Manly. So so there's a lot of kind of interesting little bits and pieces that happen around the sort of the Catholics themselves in their engagement at the student level within the university, which of course is quite different to what you've been talking about, John, which is the, you know, the sort of the more managerial leadership type of thing. But so thank you.
When you mention medicine, Anne, of course there is the extra complicating factor that there were the Catholic hospitals and that the hospitals were intrinsic to medical education. That makes for its own complications. And secondly, of course, don't forget that it was not until 1883 that medicine was established as a teaching faculty at the University of Sydney. Before that, and to this extent, it's true that the idea of the university being not an examining but a credentialing institution was relevant to medicine because their primary role in that respect was to accredit people or not, credit people who presented themselves on the basis of other qualifications. So it wasn't for another 30-odd years that the university began teaching medicine. So there were a couple of, and Woolley himself was very much in favour of the Senate's resolution to dump those early faculties, and he didn't want to have anything to do with medicine, as far as I can tell. So medicine is a little bit different in that respect. The most people starting the university thought of it as its humanities, mathematical and classical. They're all tied up with the humanities. Perhaps I should have focused on that a bit more, I suppose.
Thanks. Ed Campion wanted to ask a question, is that right? Go ahead.
The founders of the University of Sydney wanted a secular university, but as Bruce Kay says in his Colonial Religion book just recently published last year, they didn't mean a secularist university. Kay says that when they said they wanted a secular university, they did not want it narrowly denominational or ecclesiastically controlled. And the sort of people who won in the debates at the University of Sydney then set up St Paul's College. It was originally called Queen's College, presumably because Queen Victoria was a lay person, and then Trinity, and then St Paul's. And since we've got one of the council members of St Paul's here, she might like to tell us why that was done. But the crucial argument there was to keep Bishop Broughton out of control, and which they did. He was only allowed to become visitor. And so when the Catholic laity was setting up St John's College, they made sure they kept the ecclesiastical people out of the college in any controlling way, something that lasted for over 100 years until... In recent times, the sexual adventurism of the Johnsmen handed over control to the Archdiocese of Sydney.
John?
It is true. It is true that another complicating factor, of course, was that the original act, as I recall, or the original aim of the Senate was that the religious education of the students should not be neglected, and that the people with whom they lived, they had to have an association with the college to try to look after their religious education, didn't they?
They had to have a document to show they before they could get their degree, but that never happened.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Robert Gascoigne would like to ask a question. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Jim, and thank you very much, John, for your address. You've shown that in a number of significant ways there was a kind of Protestant hegemony at the university. But I suppose I'm just talking from my experience. There was also, particularly in the Department of Philosophy, a strongly secularist approach. Here I refer to Jim's excellent book, Corrupting the Youth. And so from before World War II, Jim could perhaps tell us the exact date. I think Anderson was appointed well before World War II, is that correct?
That's right, in the late 20s.
Yeah, thank you. And certainly in my experience as an undergraduate in the early 70s. So secularism was strong in philosophy. Of course, theology was excluded from the university. So I wonder how you'd see that, that in a sense a conjunction of a certain kind of Protestant hegemony, but also a strong vein of secularism in an ideological sense, I believe. Thank you.
I'm not sure. Anderson wasn't very popular with the authorities at the Sydney University, so perhaps that's, there was a tension between the Senate and the academics. I suspect that if the Senate of the University of Sydney had its ways, they'd have repudiated the appointment of Anderson, probably. But I can tell you that I can remember my friend, the late Graham Pont, philosopher, said that Dr. Woodbury down at the Aquinas Academy was the devil incarnate for them, as even though they were secularists, they talked about devil's terms, of course. And likewise, the people on the campus at Sydney University in philosophy were also the devil incarnate to Dr. Woodbury and co down at St. Patrick's. However, Graham said he had a friend who was very closely associated with both departments, and years later he showed me the first year notes that the students were given at the Aquinas Academy, and all the Andersonians were absolutely shocked and amazed at the fact that he said that they were teaching exactly the same things at both institutions, even though they hated each other. So it's a little bit hard to draw conclusions in matters like that. But you're right, Robert. Universities are heterogeneous places, and so you can get hotbeds of attitudes which are separate from those which would appeal to the administrators. But I was only quoting, in the case of, say, the dismissal case, I was only quoting what was said at the Senate, and of course the views at the staff level may have been utterly different, but in those days the Senate was much more significant and held in higher esteem and awe and respect than it is now, I suspect.
Thanks. In the year 1973, I attended simultaneously Philosophy 3 at Sydney University and Dr. Woodbury's lectures at the Aquinas Academy, and I can tell you they were not saying the same thing.
Well, they must have been saying the same thing just to the first year students, Jim.
Well, I think not. I attended first year 1972, and I wasn't at the Aquinas Academy, but I knew something about it, and philosophy at Sydney was totally different.
Yeah, right. Okay. Do we have any other questioners? Okay. I think we've just about come to the end of the allotted time in any case. So many thanks for that and for joining into the question time enthusiastically. You're welcome to our next talk by Zoom, also by Zoom, on the 17th of October. That will be Dr. Bruce Kay talking about Catholic New Testament research. Meanwhile, please see the ACHS website, the Society's website, for details on that. And for other things, you're encouraged to explore the other pages on our website, such as the journal and the newsletter, and also the large suite of resources pages on such topics as women in the Australian Church and Catholic intellectual life. And last but not least, if you're not a member, please check our membership page. We hope you'll join us. Okay, that's it. Many thanks for joining our historic first Zoom meeting, which nearly worked very well and worked adequately in any case. See you for more of the same in the future. Please invite other people. Many thanks. Goodbye.
We've been listening to a podcast of the Australian Catholic Historical Society's inaugural monthly meeting by Zoom, an event prompted by 3 months of COVID lockdown in Sydney. The Society's president, Dr. John Carmody, addressed the subject, Wentworth's Dream of a Secular University Thwarted, How Sydney University Became a Decidedly Protestant Institution. The meeting was introduced and moderated by the Society's Vice President and Journal Editor, Professor James Franklin. This podcast was produced for the Society by me, John Kenny.